People with imagination and a sense of history, people like you, are fascinated by things that are extremely old. The pyramids of Egypt, the ruins of Mayan temples, the petroglyphs on cave walls where ancient human beings huddled from enemies and the cold. Most children don't get excited about the past. They are almost totally preoccupied with the present. I grew up that way. The moment was everything. So it was quite a shock when real respect and reverence for the past came to me quite by accident when I was about 20. I had the good luck to spend 2 years in Oxford, where among a multitude of other unforgettable experiences, there was this one. Not long after I was settled, a notice on the bulletin board invited us to sign up for a trip to Stratford and a Shakespeare play. Since we were not tourists, the driver of the old battered bus took a back road up into Warwickshire, and somewhere on that winding, narrow way, he suddenly pulled off to one side and stopped. There was a low stone wall, easy to step over, and beyond that, a field of waving grass, about knee high. We couldn't imagine what he had in mind. He led us out into the field about 100 yards and then stopped us and said, "Now look down under your feet. The stones you have been walking on for the last few yards are part of an ancient Roman road." We had been eating sandwiches and talking about where we had lived back home and what we would do someday, and then all of a sudden, all of us were quiet. I can still remember the soft English breeze and the sun warming our faces, and how we knelt down to touch the stones put down by people like ourselves 2,000 years before. I was already into religious studies, and so I looked at the stone I was standing on and thought, about the time some worker put this in place, the Apostle Paul was writing those letters to young churches that make up about half of our New Testament. It was culture shock for a boy who had grown up in a town where the oldest building was only about one generation older than he was. All of which is my roundabout way of telling you that I would like to talk about the oldest piece of writing in the New Testament. A priceless antique, in fact, because it was written only 20 years after the death of Jesus. If anything else was written before that, we have no trace of it. This short letter, which I invite you to consider this morning, would be the first book of our New Testament if those books had been arranged in chronological order. We would start not with Matthew, but with the first epistle to the Thessalonians, an epistle which I am sure, by the way, Paul never dreamed would still be read. It is important to remember that because it helps us feel better about some things which are irrelevant to us and some other things in the letter which we wish Paul had made a little clearer. Here's an analogy. I move to California next week, and 10 years later, I write back to this church. I make a brief reference to the saga of the chandeliers, to what it was like in our basement beginnings at Collegiate. I drop oblique hints. I deal in nuances. Most of you get it. But if my letter lasts for even one generation, much of it will mystify readers. They will try to guess what I meant, and they will not always be sure. The implication of what I am saying is important, because this is not the kind of comment you will hear in what is called a fundamentalist or a Bible church. And if I am right in my view of this letter, then inspiration is not exactly what I was told it was as a child, and the Bible cannot be used in quite the way I was once taught to use it. Paul had established the small church in Thessalonica when he came to the city with two trusted friends, Silas and Timothy. He may have chosen it because the great highway from Rome to the eastern provinces ran right through it, with arched gates at both ends and a Roman naval station and docks to handle the city's thriving business. It already was home to two of the well-known mystery religions, and so it was not likely to be congenial to competition. It's not surprising, then, that Paul was driven out of it, just one step away from being put in prison or worse. When he got to Athens, a couple of hundred miles south, he sent for Timothy and Silas to join him, and then later, missing his new church, he sent Timothy back to see how things were. When Timothy returned with good news, this letter was written. As you might expect, it has a great deal of warmth and affection. Here are the opening words of the oldest piece of Christian writing we possess. Paul and Silas and Timothy, to the church of the Thessalonians, grace to you and peace. Now, most of that is conventional. The same kind of pattern that we use when we write, "Dear Mrs. Smith," at the beginning, and "Sincerely yours," at the end. We have an actual personal letter from those times that starts out, "Antonis Longus, to Nilus his mother, many greetings." So Paul begins in a perfectly traditional way, as he does in his other letters, except that this one is the simplest and shortest of all. To Corinth and Rome and Ephesus, he is an apostle. Here, he is just Paul. Maybe no one had challenged him yet, so that he did not have to affirm and defend his rank. "To the church of the Thessalonians" was simply an address without a zip code. But it is a little more than that for us, because the Greek word for church is ekklesia, which literally means that his friends in Thessalonica have been called out from the rest of the city to be a special people with a special mission. They are what the New English Bible calls the congregation. The usual greeting when Greeks wrote to each other was kyrene, roughly equivalent to hello. But Paul uses another word, which shares the same root. His word is charis, which means grace, or in a fuller definition, may God be even better to you than you deserve. This word, grace, is one of the great words in the Christian vocabulary. It suggests incredibly good luck, like winning a $30 million lottery when someone else bought the ticket and gave it to you as a present. Someone you had offended, in fact, and never dreamed would do you a good turn. Now, our usual preference is that people should get what they deserve. Paul wants his friends to have more than that. The modern minister is tempted to say about his deacon, who plays golf on Sunday morning, may he get what he deserves. May he slice the first drive into the lake, hook the next one into the woods, and hit three sand traps in a row. Fair enough for missing church. Fishing on Sunday? Not a nibble if I'm in charge. But Paul says this incredible God is good to the ungrateful, kind to the ones who least expect it. Remember the workers in the vineyard where the last to be hired got as much as the first? No sense in that. Grace. Remember the prodigal son and the big party thrown for him when he came home? Bad logic. Should have let him suffer for a while after what he'd done. But a party? Makes no sense. That's probably right. But the parable is not about logic or good sense. It's about grace. And when you say, "Grace be with you," to someone, you are actually saying, "May God be better to you than you deserve." If the person to whom you say it actually experiences grace, no formal definition is needed. Grace is the alcoholic rescued by intervention of those who care, saying at last, after years of denial, "All right then, I am an alcoholic. I can't help myself." And then finding in someone, some group, the strength to begin life all over again. Grace is the drug addict hitting bottom in the terrifying dark before a pinpoint of light grows like a beacon and he struggles up on somebody's strong and determined arm and finds that it was someone who simply would not stop loving him, cared for him more than he deserved. No need to tell that person what grace means. Grace is the man who came by my house one day when I was a child with a new bicycle in his pickup truck for a little boy several blocks away who lived in a miserable house and whose dad was crippled and out of work. In the moment when that man unloaded the bicycle and said, "Have fun, Tommy," and drove on back to work, grace lived. Tommy couldn't have defined the word, but he knew what grace was. And the knowing made him not quite the same person ever again. Some of you will be glad to be reminded that this mystery of grace happens in adolescence over and over again. through what seems an eternity, they appear bent on being a nuisance. If they obey at all, they do so grudgingly, until you almost wish you had not asked. They seem totally obsessed with themselves, barely aware that anyone else lives in the house. And then one day, in grace's own good time, a new spirit begins to possess them. The love they have received from others, patiently putting up with their faults, trusting them without much hope of reward, becomes a force in their own lives, and all of a sudden, they act like new persons. Obedience is changed into a free and unforced willingness. And you want to go around the house 10 times shouting, "Thank you, Lord, thank you." I've seen it happen so many times that I can say to distracted parents with deep conviction, it will be all right. Just wait. Love as wisely as you can and wait. Grace to my friends at Thessalonica. May God be better to you than you ever deserved. I know why Paul liked that word, grace. He had once been obsessed with hatred for Christians, having them thrown into jail, helping when the first martyr, Stephen, was stoned to death, and now here he is willing to die for them. How could so great a change be explained? Paul couldn't come up with a decent answer, except this one: God was better to me than I deserved. To me, who am less than the least of all saints, is this grace given that I should preach the unsearchable riches of Christ. Say what you will about Paul, who could be a difficult, thorny character at times, but say this too: he was absolutely drunk with the joy of the new life he had gotten as an undeserved gift from God. There is another word in the greeting: grace to you and peace. The first is a Greek hello. The second is Jewish. They reflect Paul's double heritage: born a Jew, brought up in a city filled with Greek influence. The common Semitic greeting was, and still is, shalom. Written in Greek, Paul translated that word by the Greek word eirene, the word from which we have our English word, proper name, Irene. I don't know how conventional the greeting may have become to some who used it, peace to you, but to Paul it was almost as important as the word grace. We speak most passionately from deep personal feeling, and Paul had been a man in absolute torment. What I want to do, I fail to do. What I don't want to do, I end up doing. Oh, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this terrible bondage? Now, you can hear that comfortably in church this morning, but if you do, you hear it all wrong. Perhaps you can't understand it if you have been so good all your life that you were never torn up inside by the way your behavior contradicted your conscience. If you have never once said, "Why am I doing this? Why am I risking everything?" And then, unable or unwilling to answer your own question, gone right on. Paul knew all about that kind of civil war. So peace, when it came, was indescribable. He called it, in fact, the peace that passes all understanding. What happened to Paul in finding that peace was internal, I think. But it became a story in the New Testament way of handling those things. And in the story, he was knocked to the ground by a blinding flash of light, heard the voice of God rebuking him, and went on to become a loyal servant of the very faith he had tried to destroy. But put all that in modern psychology and modern speech, and it is a way of saying that somehow or other, Paul saw the light. But why should he have seen it? Enemy of Christ, implacable foe of every Christian church, how could so great a change happen? Paul never completely found a reason for that, except in the beautiful word grace. And after grace, after the gift, a new freedom from hatred and guilt, when he could say what are sometimes the most wonderful words in the English language, I am at peace. Paul and Silas and Timothy to the church of the Thessalonians, grace to you and peace. We've only read the opening line, but don't be alarmed. On Sundays to come, we'll skip some parts that are not meant for us. Read the good stuff that is as relevant as ever, and get through, I hope, before you stop being curious.